Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the 17th day of January, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. Let me start off by saying that when it comes to news today, folks, there's a lot of it, but we may or may not have time to get to all the important stuff because your host has some personal news as well. I got called for jury duty and went in this morning. Wasn't even sure how long it would take. Typically, it takes quite a while before I get dismissed for cause. As I've noted literally for years on the Come Out of Her My People show and other fora where appropriate, if you understand what trial by jury once was, and that is John Jay, the first Supreme Court Justice, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson was equally clear, and literally all of those who put that thing in the Constitution understood, a juror has not only the right but the obligation to judge the facts and the law. And as Adams put it, according to his own conscience. And over the last several decades, it's been obvious what's happened to the law. That certainly has accelerated over the last couple of years. Some animals are more equal than others. But as a general rule, I've usually found it educational to go and see how it is that they condition the jury, eliminate all of those that have any understanding of what law once meant, and basically pick people that are malleable and not particularly aware of what's really going on. But it is always educational to see how they hone their techniques. And this was particularly interesting because the small, relatively sparsely populated rural county where your host lives has in the past been, well, let's just call it a bit more transparent when it comes to, will you swear to judge the facts only and the law as I give it to you, which is a great opportunity for anybody who knows what trial by jury really is to stand up and say, of course I can't and won't. But evidently, the judge for the trial I was called in for has been around the block a bit more. He seems to have been almost a rover called in for this particular situation. And I noticed he was more careful to kind of work those words in, but not make quite as big of a deal about them, at least up front, to the point where anybody who knew better could object. So it was interesting to see how all of this developed. Well, to make a long story short, I actually made the first cut, didn't get eliminated before the large group was in fact interviewed individually, first by the district attorney and then later, but I didn't get that far, by the pro se defendant. I'll certainly share more of the story on upcoming Come Out of Her My People shows, perhaps even this afternoon if I get everything ready in time. Suffice it to say, the judge actually did at some point actually utter the words jury nullification, asked me if I knew what it meant, and I basically responded, yes, sir, I certainly do, and it's at the heart of the concept of trial by jury. And, of course, following that, with a mutual glance between the judge and the district attorney, dismissed for cause. By the way, folks, it'll be particularly interesting for your host to now go back and do what properly screened jurors aren't supposed to even think about doing. And that's look up the statute that this fellow was being charged under. Yeah, I can truthfully say, and I did, that I'd like to see the evidence before forming an opinion. But I can also say, as I listened to the kind of questions the DA was very intent on making sure the jurors didn't seem to understand, the words void for vagueness were front and center in my mind. So on to the other top headlines in lawless, post-constitutional, yep, America with a K. And I do think we have to start here. Speaker for the Congress, traitors, Nancy Pelosi, has basically disinvited that fellow who they think is an imposter in the White House, the duly elected president of the United States, from coming and giving the State of the Union message. They don't want to hear from him. And she has some pretty bogus-sounding reasons why. Starting with, yeah, there's a shutdown in place. So you stay home. Zero Hedge's headline is typical of those that aren't buying the excuses. Trump has been disinvited from making the State of the Union address by top Democrats, says their headline. The formal invitation, the story notes, is traditionally made by the Speaker of the House to the President several weeks before each State of the Union address. But speaking with the Criminally Negligent Network, House Majority Leader Representative Steny Hoyer said President Trump had been disinvited from making the address. And the State of the Union is off. For her part, the speaker for the progressive leftist pointed to security concerns. Yeah, sure. Saying the partial government shutdown has crippled both the U.S. Secret Service and the Department of Homeland Security, which may compromise security measures that precede the primetime address, according to Politico. They did admit later on that the staff of the leftists have been discussing the idea of postponing the State of the Union for months and just looking for an excuse, it would seem. Quote, Sadly, she wrote, given the security concerns, and unless government reopens this week, I suggest we work together to determine another suitable date after government has reopened for this address, or for you to consider delivering your State of the Union address in writing to the Congress on January 29th. Translation, they certainly don't want to give him another bully pulpit to haul them over the coals again. Or maybe if we just impeach you sooner, we'll find somebody else we'd rather hear from. Representative Steve Scalise was pretty blunt, too. He tweeted the following, hashtag shutdown Nancy's decision to shut down the State of the Union was never about security. It was about the obstruction of at real Donald Trump, plain and simple. In other words, it's all about politics. Oh, there's a shocker. This after Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen had pointed out that both the DHS and the U.S. Secret Service are fully prepared to support and secure the State of the Union. In other words, you guys are lying through your teeth and full of it. We thank the service for their mission, focus, and dedication, and for all they do each day to secure our homeland. And for crying out loud, folks, this is transparently, obscenely ridiculous. Because if there's one thing that Chuckie Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and the leftists really understand, it's covering their own little you-know-whats. They, of course, have fully armed details when you peons aren't allowed even to keep and bear arms. And I guarantee you, if there's a critical government function they'd have squealed even louder about, it's making sure that they were safe. So who are we kidding? And there are obviously no shortage of reasons why the leftists might not want this president to be allowed the platform of a State of the Union address, especially since the State of the Union involves so much criminality that keeps getting revealed, whether they obstruct justice, destroy evidence, and appoint the guilty to serve on Mueller's witch hunt or not. According to a new report by award-winning investigative journalist, isn't it cool we still have a few of those around, John Solomon, former top DOJ official Bruce Orr, you know the name of these criminals by now, warned FBI and DOJ officials that Steele's bogus dossier was connected to none other than Hillary Clinton and cautioned them that it might, who could have imagined such a thing, be biased. And this was weeks before they obtained the bogus FISA warrant on Carter Page. More evidence of a setup. Interestingly, though, but no longer surprising, this crucial information provided to the FBI by Bruce Orr was omitted weeks later from the FISA warrant application that the Federal Bureau of Investigation submitted to the unconstitutional FISA court in order to be allowed to spy on Donald Trump's presidential campaign through advisor Carter Page. Solomon of the Hill further reported that Orr's activities, chronicled in handwritten notes and congressional testimony he said he gleaned from sources, provide the most damning evidence to date that FBI and DOJ officials may have misled federal judges in October of 2016 in their zeal to obtain that warrant targeting Trump advisor Carter Page just weeks before Election Day, perhaps because they could already see the handwriting on the wall. They also contradict, he continues, a key argument that House Democrats have made in their formal intelligence-sick conclusions about the Russia case, and since it was disclosed last year that Steele's dossier formed a, if not the, central piece of evidence, again, I gotta say sick there, supporting the FISA warrant, just us and FBI officials have been vague about exactly when they learned that Steele's work was paid for by the law firm representing the Clinton campaign and the DNC. There is, of course, a whole lot more to this. Someday you may even hear the rest of it. But Solomon points out that Bruce Orr's testimony about his contacts with top DOJ officials in the summer of 2016 destroys Adam Schiffless's junkie counter-memo, where he argued that Bruce Orr's contacts with the FBI began, quote, weeks after the election and more than a month after the court approved the initial FISA application. In other words, folks, once again, we see that they were lying through their teeth, and all of this has all the hallmarks of a witch hunt, still in progress. By the way, in case you aren't aware of it, the FBI is required to present exculpatory evidence. That means evidence that shows, this may not be exactly what we're claiming, to the FISA court. So by omitting that information, it's clear that the corrupt Obama FBI DOJ abused the clearly unconstitutional, anyway, star chamber system. And if you understand how tyranny works, folks, you have to say, ultimately, that's the point. Because guess which corrupt former FBI head all of these unindicted co-conspirators then went to work for? There's literally tons of similar stuff coming out now. given the partial government shutdown. No wonder you're not hearing much about it. Here's just a headline or so from a related piece having to do with the New York Times' latest Russia smokescreen and tacit admission buried way within that they didn't really have any actual evidence anyway. Former agent Ray McGovern via Consortium News, other sources including Zero Hedge, points out that Brennan, Comey, and of course the other co-conspirator criminals here are pulling a Hoover on Trump. And the headline quotes Brennan's famous line, "I don't do evidence," which really seems more and more apropos, doesn't it? This is a reference to the fact that New York Times readers had to get all the way down, if they read that far, to paragraph 9 to read that when it came to this bogus investigation, quote, "No evidence has emerged publicly that Mr. Trump was secretly in contact with or took direction from Russian government officials," unquote. That didn't stop him from all kinds of innuendo. Four paragraphs later, notes the former agent, the Times writers did note that a vigorous debate had taken shape among former law enforcement officials over whether FBI investigators, sick, had overreacted. And all of that was evidently what Republican Representative Trey Gowdy was wondering when he finally grilled former CIA director and perjurer John Brennan on May 23, 2017, as to what actual evidence he had provided to the FBI to catalyze its so-called investigation of Trump-Russia collusion. To which Brennan famously replied, "And for once, truthfully, I don't do evidence," unquote. It's just that now we know that there was a whole lot more to that statement in kind of a truly Clintonian fashion than the waste stream has wanted to talk about ever since. Here's a headline the Judicial Watch calls a major victory for accountability. We'll see if it finally matters or not. A federal judge has actually ordered the likes of Rhodes, Rice, and other Obama officials to respond over the Clinton-Benghazi email treason and subsequent cover-up, saying it was a grave offense and smacks of outrageous misconduct. Yeah, but if the Stonewall continues, was there sound? No doubt the big continuing story from across the pond has to do with arguably discredited Prime Minister and Brexit saboteur Theresa May. She did, however, yesterday barely escape a vote of no confidence. So the saga continues, which inclines your host to recap some of the major developments out of the biggest story in what's left of the European Union. And admittedly, folks, the real difficulty here is trying to sort through the EU propaganda and figure out what's really going on amidst all the smoke. To that end, I've assembled a number of stories, and we'll kind of go through them in, order of increasing clarity, hopefully. Starting with an aggregation of British and European sources. Theresa May says the UK's Daily Mail suffered an historic landslide defeat in the Commons tonight, losing her Brexit deal by an incredible margin, 432 to 202, a margin of 230, and that's the biggest in modern history. She suffered a rebellion, they say, of 118 of her own members of Parliament, with the group including a raft of former ministers. Tony Purslove and Eddie Hughes quit as ministerial aides to join the rebels. It was, they continue, the biggest Tory rebellion in decades, worse than anything faced by David Cameron, John Major, or Margaret Thatcher. The revolt included more than a third of her entire 317-strong party and was led by ringleaders Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg. All right, well, you get the impression it was kind of nasty, and you'd think, this is kind of what we as outsiders would understand, that any self-respecting prime minister would accept the humiliation, recognize the rebuff, and resign. Here's one summary of such. By all accounts, the kind of historic defeat just suffered by Prime Minister Theresa May when the Commons overwhelmingly rejected her Brexit withdrawal agreement by a massive margin would have prompted the average British leader to resign in disgrace. But these are not normal times. Well, that's a charitable way to put it. But how about this? Not so Theresa May, who still seems to have a sabotage to complete. A lot of Brits no doubt remember that Theresa May campaigned against Brexit. Then her party and the waste-stream media decides it's legitimate for her to be leading the negotiations for withdrawal. Yeah, sure. The good news seems to be a whole lot of folks saw through the sellout and weren't even willing to accept the watered-down version that she, along with the EU ministers, kept trying to slam down people's throats. Here's a line from the waste-stream coverage that kind of helps to make that point a bit more clear. the EU has hinted that Brexit should now be cancelled after Theresa May's deal was voted down in the biggest defeat suffered by a PM in over 100 years. EU Council President Donald Tusk suggested that if MPs cannot agree on a deal and don't want to crash out without one, they should consider reversing the historic vote.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, that one's no doubt sticking in the throats of a whole lot of Brexit Brits this morning. And rather than resigning, May has vowed to press ahead with another round of negotiations, pledging to reach across party lines. What, isn't that what she's been doing? To hammer out a deal that would have a chance of winning approval in the Commons. But even if that's successful, it's unclear whether the EU dictators would accept it. Obviously, their deep state swamp is full of crocodiles, too. And the fact that a whole bunch of other European Union leaders have weighed in may not be helping the situation, except as far as pushing Brits to realize what's really going on. For example, EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker warned that time is almost up, as he announced no-deal planning will be ramped up in the wake of defeat. Now remember, folks, no deal means, hey, no exit, basically, or at least all kinds of taxes and other things that we're going to punish you with. The aforementioned EU Council President Tusk said, if a deal is impossible, and no one wants no deal, then who will finally have the courage to say what the only positive solution is? Unquote. And by that, I think he means cave to the inevitable, Britain, as opposed to telling the EU to go stuff it. Oh, and I guess we do have to quote the beleaguered communist French, I'm not going to say leader, because that no longer seems apropos, Emmanuel Macron, echoing other European leaders, said that the EU has, quote, reached the maximum of what it can offer the UK, and they won't sacrifice any more European interest to help the UK resolve its internal squabbles. This according to RT, which is no doubt more objective than most of the European sources. Which brings me next to a pretty decent summary of the situation, written by a Brit for Americans, courtesy of author and columnist Vox Day, American residing in Italy, who begins by saying anyone thinking that we're inconsistent or giving up, or will ever give up, is kidding themselves. We would have been out of the EU a decade ago, but Blair and Cameron broke the principle of candidate selection by local party management and imposed shortlists of approved candidates from the central party offices. Think swamp critters, folks. This was an attempt to prevent infighting, they say, and create a consistent message to make the parties electable after the disasters of the Foot and Kinnock election attempts back in the 80s and 90s, Labour Party, and Haig, Duncan, Smith, and Howard in the early aughts, that would be the Conservative Party, and the Burkean ideal says this subject of the crown was shattered by this, and therefore the MPs simply do not even reflect the views of the ordinary party members of either the Labour Party or Conservative Party, let alone ordinary voters. This, in other words, is why there's a huge disconnect between the referendum result and the views in Westminster. Trouble is, the issue simply wouldn't go away. Precisely because there was such an establishment consensus on staying in the EU. The party leaders on both sides took the view that they could simply ignore it because, quote, where else are our voters going to go? Does that sound familiar, folks? Well, eventually, after trying almost every other option first to make the traditional Burkean arrangement work, the voters decided to go elsewhere. Here follows a brief timeline dating back to May 2014, where the voters put UKIP in as the largest party in the EU elections. And in case you've forgotten, folks, that's the UK Independent Party, initially founded by Nigel Farage. The hard left prefers to call them right wing. One thing's for sure, they're very much Eurosceptic. Cameron then realized the Tories were toast in the general election unless he offered those UKIP voters a reason to return. Here the author notes the Kippers, as they're called, are about two-thirds conservative and one-thirds Labour. He thought he could promise a referendum and then bargain that away in negotiations with the Liberal Democrats. In other words, the classic bait and switch. Come May 2015, they voted Cameron a majority, so he couldn't bargain away that manifesto commitment to an EU referendum. June 2016, of course, the famous vote to leave, by exactly what was predicted in the previous year. And here the author notes the EU is a lot like Hitlery. Everybody's opinion was already formed. Publicity campaigns were never going to change anyone's mind, or ultimately, the real results. In June of 2017, Theresa May wanted a huge majority. Projections were she would have easily had enough conservatives to win the vote last night, but she got arrogant, says the author, and blew it by stepping on that third rail of British politics, what they call the Alzheimer's tax, demonstrating she couldn't be trusted, and leading inexorably to the result of Tuesday night. Of course, the author says, Brexit was always going to be this way. It was always going to take trench warfare to get out. It was obvious from the EU's negotiating position back on 28 March of 2017, the day before Article 50, that there could never be an agreement with the EU because the Brits could never accept those terms. Even if, the author says, the quisling politicians accepted them, the voters would later simply repudiate them using the 1970 Treaty of Vienna. The EU, the author continues, seems to persistently operate under the fantasy that any British government can make commitments to the future. Now, this is interesting and probably will sound a bit strange to Americans. It can't, because the most fundamental principle of the British Constitution is that no parliament may bind a future parliament. Nevertheless, the EU wants to keep us bound to unchanging commitments, which is an axiomatic impossibility, because we'd later simply unbind ourselves. Now, here I pause for a second to note that, hey, interestingly enough, people would say similar things about the Constitution, like how it was the supreme law of the land, and that laws that are in violation of it aren't any law at all, which is, of course, true. That doesn't necessarily mean that Big Brother is going to listen to or even read his own law, witness the new so-called Congress. And here the author notes, EU citizens are somewhat like the Brits who decide to move to the USA and then can't cope with the fact that they do things differently over there. We're not Europe. We have a common law system. Hey, folks, we used to have that in America, too. And fundamentally different concepts of law and relationship between the citizen and the state. Oh, and the author adds, we drive on the correct side of the road. All right, well, I guess we can forgive them a little bit of that. If there's another referendum, says the author, we'll vote to Brexit in exactly the same numbers. The author talks about a Channel 4 news presenter named Jon Snow, who went to Leeds to interview younger citizens, 18 to 20-year-olds, who hadn't voted back in 2016, and then was astonished to discover they were even more adamant about Brexit than older voters. It's always a conceit of the left, a false conceit, says the author, that they are the future. Bottom line, Theresa May won't authorize another referendum because it would open the door to all kinds of referenda on other topics the progressives want to avoid. There's an entire list of them here, from the death penalty and abortion to asylum to all kinds of other deplorable topics, things having to do with Scotland and Wales and so forth. Again, there isn't going to be another referendum on anything ever if the establishment can prevent it. And furthermore, even if they manage to stop Brexit for the moment, it'll still remain the central issue of British politics until we're out of the EU. Meanwhile, nothing else is getting done in government. Brexit occupies 100% of government CPU capacity. They simply can't wish Brexit away much as they would like to. And if this attempt to leave is stopped, the electorate will do precisely what Cameron was trying to prevent way back when, and abandon both of the two main parties in order to achieve Brexit. The author does begin to conclude by saying, I think a really hilarious possibility would be that if we're prevented from leaving, then a Salvini of Italy and Hungary's Orban grouping takes control of the EU Parliament, maybe, and the selection of Juncker's replacement. Well, that, of course, assumes an honest election is even a remote possibility, but let's go with it for a minute. All of a sudden, I can just see British Remain supporters horrified. Whoa, whoa, we didn't mean to stay in this EU. We wanted the Merkel-Macron version. On a grander level, it wraps up. This is kind of like the C.S. Lewis novel, That Hideous Strength, from back in 1945, where Britain was covertly conquered by an apparently benign European bureaucracy. But the fact is, writes this Brit, the problems are really caused by the Franco-German addiction to empire building on the European continent. We only went to war, it says, against Napoleon, the Kaiser, and Hitler because they were empire building in Europe. Not because of the unpleasant domestic activities they may have been engaged in. Whether an empire is established peacefully, by war, or by hook, or by crook, people are still going to resist. Nationalism, it says, is sticking within your own borders. And that, by the way, sounds like a pretty interesting and reasonable definition. And it concludes thusly. It stopped the 30 years war. It's the Westphalian solution. It is the path to peace, stability, and prosperity. I guess as we wrap things up for today and ponder all the attempts at civil war, literally worldwide at this point, not to mention other kinds of war too, we have to ask, if the so-called progressives aren't thwarted, is there a path to peace and prosperity anywhere? Or for that matter, even a remaining rule of law? And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.